Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts the Restoration offers for today's world. We aim to feature a variety of guests with roots in the Restoration tradition from Community of Christ and our friends from The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The music has been provided by Ben Howington. You can find his music at mormonguitar.com.
Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. I'm your host, Brittany Mangelson, and today we have on Darren Goebel, who, if those of you who are on Facebook probably will know who he is and recognize him from there, but he is a priest in Las Vegas, Nevada, and he is an admin on the Community of Christ dialogue page on Facebook. And we're just going to sit and chat and hear more about his story and his life. I think that there's interesting things that he will bring to the table, and he has a really good perspective on things, and so we're just gonna kick back and chit-chat and have a good time. So welcome, Darren.
Thank you.
So let's start at the beginning. I'm excited for this because I don't know your beginning stories. Were you born and raised in the church? Was your family converted? I know that you said that you had some interesting stories to tell, so please tell them.
Oh, I don't know. Did I say interesting?
Well,
it's a combination of conversion and family history. When my mother was high school age, my grandparents started looking for a church home. And for my grandfather, what became very important to him in searching was the form of baptism. Mm-hmm. He worked the oil fields, and during some downtime, he prayed about it. And he said he looked up, and in the distance, he could see Jesus being immersed into the water and back up. So for him, full immersion was a very important aspect of finding a church home. And as him and Grandma continued to pray, soon after that, a couple of RLDS missionaries visited. And because of our practice of full immersion, it was important to Grandpa and Grandma, and that was part of their decision to join the church. And after they joined the church, Grandpa found out that he was actually a third-generation RLDS member. His mother passed away when he was very young, so he did not know the church connection or have any involvement in it growing up. So it was just kind of interesting as he pursued it. The things that were important to him that the RLDS did, he ended up being a third-generation member. And so that makes me sixth generation, of course. When I was younger, my father was in the Navy, so Mom and Dad moved around every couple of years, so we never were involved in church. And when we lived in Corpus Christi, Mom wanted to get involved in church. So I would have been kindergarten age, so 5 or 6. So she called the church, and it turned out she called the LDS church, forgetting the name RLDS. So a couple of young missionaries came, and I do remember that. I don't know their names, but I just remember us making construction paper chains and just different activities and things that they did that night. And after they left, Mom was so embarrassed that she called the wrong church. We never went to church until, except when we visited grandparents during the summer. And then when I was in junior high, Grandpa and Grandma finally, and we moved to San Diego, Grandpa and Grandma called around to find a local congregation for us. And contacted the Chula Vista RLDS, and we started going there. So I was 15 when I started, a week before I turned 15, started going to church. So it was sixth generation, but having never been involved, it was a conversion experience, a conversion membership as well. So just kind of funny how that all worked out, I think.
Yeah, and definitely interesting. I think interesting is a good word to describe it. So what was your... What were your thoughts on the church growing up? I mean, if you weren't raised religious up until that point, what were the things that you liked about the community or about what you were learning? Or, I mean, did you have a lot of, theological thoughts going on in your head or anything like that?
Not really. It was more, for me personally, it was more of a sense of just trying to find a place to belong. And we had what was then called cottage meetings. I don't know if anybody still calls it cottage meetings, but elders Ken and his father Earl Norton came to the house for several weeks in a row and presented traditional church history and basic beliefs of the church. So it that was my, I guess, my foundation. But to be honest, it was never important. It was more just trying to fit in and find a place that was mine.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. I think that, yeah, my growing up, I would say, was similar to that. You know, church becomes your community pretty fast. So I guess to give us a time frame of this, like what year was this about?
We first started going in October of 84.
84.
So it would have been a week before my 15th birthday.
It's an interesting time to be entering into the church, and the church's history.
Well, World Conference was already over.
And yeah.
Doctrine and Covenants 156 was already scripture. So by the time I started participating in church, that was all history. I was not a part of any of the debates, any of the excited feelings or hurt feelings or any of the what made up the fabric of that time. Mm-hmm. Baptized a year later. So women were already being ordained by the time I was baptized. So it was already said and done by the time I started attending. So it was never an issue for me.
Yeah. So it was just your normal, what you were walking into. How was the congregation with it? Cause I know that some congregations, really struggled with it and, continued to wrestle with it for years and years afterwards. Was your congregation, you know, overall accepting of it immediately, or was there still that tension?
I don't remember there being any tension in the San Diego district. One of the very first people ordained. Now, I do remember I attended Chula Vista congregation, and at the time there was five or six congregations in the San Diego district. And Lois Kaziaka from the Claremont congregation was one of the very first women ordained in the entire church. So she, nobody was going to be ordained first. So there was a start date for ordinations so that nobody could ever be the first woman ordained. So in the first groupings of people being ordained, she was in one of the first groupings. And I do remember, I didn't know her yet. She later became a very important family friend and, I probably consider her an early mentor in my life, but I do remember in Chula Vista the discussion of do we want to close down the Chula Vista branch and we all go up to Claremont for the ordination or leave it open in case there were visitors. So I do remember that discussion, but I do not remember there ever being any widespread disgruntlement. I'm sure there were individuals who were probably still struggling with it. I don't know if there were any congregations. I don't remember there ever being congregations because I remember there being female priesthood members in all the congregations.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. So, I mean, it sounds like that they were probably supportive of it if they were considering, you know, everybody going up for the ordination. Yeah, that's awesome. So you're at church, right when women are being ordained, you're a teenager. What was your young adulthood like? I mean, did you, cause I know, I mean, I guess spoiler alert that you did step away from the church for a while. So let's like lead up into that and maybe talk about your reasons for stepping away and, yeah, I guess up until that point.
Well, I probably stepped away a couple times. There are only two that are really significant. Most of it was just busy life and more interesting and fun things to do than going to church on Sunday or Wednesday night. But the first time I struggled with church, my grandfather gave me an old book called The Truth and the Evidence. And it basically discussed the differences between LDS and RLDS and how evil and horrible Brigham Young was and just, you know, polygamy and just some of those major differences between the two churches that defined the RLDS identity for so many decades. And I remember reading that it was just a little teeny tiny book. And I remember reading that, I just remember being so mad and how could people believe Brigham Young when, you know, we, like the book says, we have the truth and the evidence. And as I started studying more, most of the literature that I found was, I guess, what you would call anti-Mormon. So it'd be stuff like from the Tanners, that book, The God Makers, Mormonism, Mama and Me, several other ones. Some are written better than others, and some are obviously written to be sensational. But as I started reading all this stuff and just, you know, how could the Mormons be duped by Brigham Young? And then I started realizing a lot of the things that they were quoting were from Joseph Smith. And a lot of the stuff that they were discussing were things that happened prior to the assassination in 1844. And then it occurred to me, well, that was still when we and the LDS were one church. And
yeah.
So I started struggling with some of that stuff. And it turned into issues like the First Vision and why were there so many different versions of the First Vision. And, you know, you have one where it's God the Father and the Son, and then one where it's just God, and one where it's just the Son, and one where it's an angel, one where it's a group of angels. And it was so different from one to the other. It just made you wonder what the truth was. And just issues with the Book of Mormon, the historicity of it. I probably just mispronounced that word and embarrassed myself in front of everybody. a lot of the main issues most people have when they're looking beyond the pages of the Book of Mormon. And I remember once in my early 20s, I wrote Wallace B. Smith and asked, well, why don't you pray about the First Vision and find out what really happened? And his response back to me was, you know, at this late date, what would it matter? It just confused things even more. And I thought, okay, you know, and at the time that really kind of irritated me. But then, you know, as I get older and slightly wiser, I realize, you know, that's true, because people have what they think is the truth, and no matter what else you add to it, their truth is the truth. And you know, but that my first walk away was based off of historical and theological concerns I had at the time.
So I just want to point out that Wally B. would have been the prophet president at the time, correct? And you wrote him, and he wrote you back, and that is amazing. I still have a hard time, like, conceptualizing that is a thing in Community of Christ.
That probably would have been
that you can
90, maybe 90,
18,
9, oh. 90, 91, somewhere in there.
Yeah. So, that's amazing.
Several years before he retired. But what got me through that is I was attending a very conservative Southwest Baptist University in Ball River, Missouri. And it just slowly dawned on me through that experience of resigning. And when I resigned, I wrote three letters. One went to the president of the church, one went to our district president, and then one went to my pastor, who was my grandfather, and explained that I was resigning officially. I wanted my name taken off the rolls, and, you know, and I listed some of the reasons why. And all that. Grandpa never said anything about that. Well, actually, nobody ever did. I did get one letter from the church secretary saying that you received your letter and your wishes will be, you know, we'll follow your wishes or whatever. But from that experience and going through Southwest Baptist, you know, I realize my relationship with God is not based on what I think of Joseph Smith or whether the truth of Joseph Smith is the real truth or not the real truth. And I realized my relationship had to be with God. It could not be with history. I could not base it strictly so much on history. And that was a good couple of years of wandering through that desert to get to the other side. And I remember going on a field trip to Independence because we had a class called Understanding the Cults. And we went up there to Unity Village and did the tour and met with somebody, and he answered our questions. And then we went to the LDS Visitor Center that is across the street from the auditorium and the temple and Church of Christ. And they answered some questions as well. And then we went to the auditorium, and this is when the temple is still being built. So the temple was being built, but it wasn't finished yet. And we went to the auditorium, and Peter Judd was the person that was our host and answering questions for us. And I don't remember any questions anybody asked or any of the answers he gave now. I do remember his expressions and how he answered. And so this is towards the end of my struggling, and I wish I could remember what it was that he said, but it convinced me that I need to be where I'm called to be, and that's where I was called to be. So as we got done, I stayed behind a little bit and chatted with him and asked him to if he could reinstate my name. He couldn't. I had to do it through a pastor in a congregation, so I moved back to San Diego. Pastor of the Claremont congregation reinstated me as a member. So it was a different process. It was long, and I kind of wish instead of just being baptized to find a place, I had really been mature enough and smart enough to do more investigation and developing that relationship with God first instead of having the baptismal experience and then developing that relationship.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of people can relate to that. I mean, even those that get baptized at 8, you know, I mean, not to downplay an 8-year-old's intelligence or relationship with God, but sometimes I wonder, you know, 8 is really young. I mean, that's just my kids in a couple of years. I look back on, you know, my baptism, my LDS baptism when I was 8, and I think, like, man, I should have, you know, had the opportunity to walk through some things a little bit more. Okay, so what's the process like to be accepted back into the church? I mean, you don't have to be rebaptized, do you? Is it just kind of filling out paperwork? And
I just went to, I don't know if I talked to him directly or sent him a letter before I moved back to San Diego. But I just talked to the pastor and he said he'd take care of it. And I guess it's just a form he fills out and sends it back in. Well, at the time it probably would have been for me. Now they probably do it online. But yeah, it was all taken care of.
I like that. I like that it can kind of be just a quiet thing that doesn't have to be, you know, this big hullabaloo, I guess. Like a re-baptism or, you know, going in front of the congregation or anything that's like dramatic and a big show. So that's cool that it can just kind of be, you know, between you and the pastor and God, really. Cool. So have you been active in the church since that point then?
For the most part, what year would that have been? So I was active during that time. So that would have been still the early 90s. And then I stopped going, but it was just one of those, the way life goes, sort of stopping. There was no, you know, deep reasons or emotional hangups or, you know, anything like that. It was just life happened. And I did get into drugs and for a couple of years, and I wasn't doing it long, but I did it pretty dang hard. And I'm probably lucky I survived based off of the amount I did and what I was doing and in the places I was doing it at. As I was stopping, this would have been probably the end of 93, the beginning of 94, and trying to put my life back together, Lois, that I mentioned earlier. I always wanted to work for the church, which I imagine a lot of church people like to do. And she encouraged me because I liked books and loved to read. And I tried to write poetry, encouraged me to write Herald House and ask for a job. Well, the temple, you know, was open, is going to be dedicated at that conference. So I wrote to the bookshop and just said, hey, I want a job. And at the time, it was all volunteers. And I guess there were not bad issues, but just some consistency issues with an all-volunteer staff. And the lady in charge of the volunteers told me later that my letter was an answer to her prayers. And she sent it to the management at Herald House. And I got a call from Dick Fortman. And I was offered to come out for World Conference and work for Herald House for that week. And if they liked me and I liked them, I would have a job. So I cashed my tax refund, and Mom bought me a one-way ticket to Kansas City. So I had a one-way ticket to Kansas City with $200 in my pocket and a job that was only going to last maybe a week. And that was scary. And I don't remember what your question was. Your question was now.
No, just keep talking. This is good.
It was a good experience. It's one of those experiences I wish I had been more appreciative of at the time. It's one of those where the hindsight's, you can see it better than you can as a young 20-year-old, first time on your own. I do appreciate, especially when I worked at the Temple Bookshop, I worked with a lot of volunteers. And of course, a lot of them were older, retired folks. And if it had not been for those people, there would have been some weeks where I would not have any food at all. I would not have had clean clothes. My first set of dishes came from one of the volunteers. My first piece of furniture other than my bed came from a volunteer. And it was just a humbling experience, more humbling now than it was then. I don't know how to explain that other than just maturity. And it's one of those things I've always wished I'd been able to pay back. But it was a good experience. It was a good experience. I really appreciated being there because you got to meet people from all over the world. You got to meet people who you've only saw their name on the cover of books or in the Herald, and it was nice. I got to participate in the prayer for peace, and that was a really lovely thing. Frances Easter was in charge of it at the time, and she was a beautiful, forthright woman who was very gracious in guiding me in some of the things when it came to the prayer for peace and worship. It was a very good experience overall, and I wish I would have handled it better than what I did and with more graciousness on my part at the time. It was a very good experience, and I'm glad, even for as short of a time period it was, that I still had that experience.
Yeah, well, I mean, don't beat yourself too much over it. I think that we all have those moments where we look back and think like, oh man, I handled that very immaturely. that's life, I guess. So to kind of shift gears a little bit, how does your sexuality play into all this? You're gay, and it has only been, you know, in recent years that the church has been open to marriage and ordination for the LGBTQ community. And I mean, even that, it's not everywhere in the church, you know. The churches that, or the countries that have held national conferences for it. How were you able to reconcile, I guess, who you were with the church? And did you date, or did you want to get married, or did you want to go into ministry at all, but knew that that wouldn't be an option, or what was going through your mind in relation to that part of yourself?
Well, I never struggled in church with it. I've never made a point to discuss it, but I've never made a point to hide it. I think I handled myself the same way everybody else does. I was there, you know. I don't think it ever had an impact on opportunities I had to try to provide ministry at church, because I was helping plan services and, presiding, and a few times preaching and facilitating conversation in the worship experience in my congregation. And like I said, I was able to participate in the prayer for peace. So it's never been an issue that for me. I don't know if it's been an issue for other people, and if it was, it was their issue, not mine. And what I mean by an issue with me, not in general. So I'm not saying that they hadn't other people. I just mean with me specifically.
So you felt like you were still utilized and still plugged into the congregation and everything to the best of your abilities and at a comfort level that you were okay with?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And when I was going to the Peace Chapel in Kansas City, and that's where I attended church when I moved to Independence, I didn't wait to be asked. I didn't wait to be asked to volunteer. I just pushed my way into it, basically, and just did it. And there were some good experiences. I got to work with some good people from the World Church who we invited as guest ministry and with my own congregation. And it was good, but it was never a struggle with the church. I never, maybe when I was younger in my teens, it was one of those, oh, you know, take this away from me, God, and prayers like that, until the, I don't know, realization, confirmation, insight that, you know, I am as I was created to be, for whatever reason. I don't have an answer for it, but after having that sense of peace with it, it's just never been an issue. But yes, I'd like to date. So if anybody ever comes to Las Vegas and wants to take me out, I am interested, maybe. As far
maybe.
As getting married, let's wait until we have the date and find out. It's just never been an issue. Now, I am aware, of course, with the many friends I've had over the years and with the acquaintances we both have on Facebook, that there is still a lot of issues and a lot of pain and hurt. I don't know, just a lot of burden that people carry with either trying to accept who they are or others trying to accept them, who they are, and then dealing with that struggle. And I know it's not an easy thing. And my side, I think that is part of what we're called to do, is bear each other's burdens. There's a phrase I always use, is meet people where they are, not where we want them to be. That's one of our callings, and if we can remember that, I think we can do more good than harm.
Yeah, definitely. So, I guess, what was your thought process as you watched the conversation go throughout the church in the U.S.? discussing the topic of LGBT ordination and marriage leading up to National Conference. Were you heavily involved in those conversations, or were you just kind of quietly sitting back and waiting to, you know, see what would happen? Or
I think a part of it was trying to discern for myself where I felt God was leading us in that. And I'll be honest, there were moments where I struggled with it. I mean, is this really what, you know, is this where God's leading us or not? I think for the most part, to my memory, Leon and some of our other friends might have different memories than I have. I think I tried not to get overly involved in it. And as we got closer and closer to it, my focus became more on remembering those who are suffering through the process. Because no matter what was decided, somebody was going to feel hurt. And somebody was going to feel left out, left behind. And for me, that was my biggest concern. I think that was more a concern for me than what the decision was actually going to be, if that makes sense.
No, it does.
I think the decision that God led us through, or led us to, and the process that we were led through to get there was the right decision. I think those who invested the energy to try to understand others, whether they ever agreed with them or not, or whether their opinions of the issues being discussed ever changed, I think the ability to try to listen and to understand, I think that's what helped us survive the discussion and the conference more intact than we did back in 84 with the Women in the Priesthood issue. It was a group discussion, and people were able to express themselves in the different listening groups and the different mission center discussions. And then the way I wasn't at the national conference, so a lot of what I know about it is everybody else who went telling me about it. But I think the process was very clear that it tried to include as many voices as possible and tried to make sure as many of them were heard.
Yeah, which I think is amazing. I mean, every time, I feel like we've talked about National Conference a lot on the podcast, but it's incredible to me that a group of people that large, you know, that big, a group of people to that capacity can come away with this common vision of the church in this place at this time. And I think that, you know, it's still such a polarizing topic in the political sphere and, you know, everywhere else. And I know that there's people in Community of Christ that, you know, that are in the U.S. That still disagree. And I've seen them disagree on Facebook or whatever. But it's nothing like what I see in other places. And so I think that everybody, whether they disagreed or agreed, was touched and grew through that. And yeah, I think it's absolutely amazing what happened. So let's talk about Facebook for a little bit. You are the admin, or, you know, a admin on the Community of Christ Dialogue page. And I think that it's fascinating because it has members and friends of the church from all over the place. And we're talking, you know, lifelong members that may veer more towards maybe some of the restoration branches, to LDS people that are interested, to everything in between. You know, sometimes we get people on there that are have no attachment or relation to the restoration at all, and they're just interested, and it's fascinating. And some of the conversations can get pretty heated. But I mean, there's still that there's a tension there, but there's still just this faithful disagreement lived out. And I guess that's why I love that group so much, is because I feel like that's where I've seen faithful disagreement lived out the most. So what is it like being an admin and trying to juggle all of that and make sure that voices get heard and affirmed, and yet try to keep things drama-free and respectful and all that?
Well, there's seven other admin, or, well, I have it pulled up so I can make sure I didn't lose anybody if I mention anybody by name. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. There are seven other admin, and then two that are not admin per se, but they're part of our admin group. And we really, the group of admins, we do a lot of talking about what's going on in the group. So we are the good things and our challenges, our opportunities, I guess I should say. I think it's a great opportunity. I think, I swing from feeling extremely blessed by the group to frustrated because I don't know how to respond sometimes to certain things. I appreciate the community that's there because I know for a lot of our friends, there is not a community of Christ close to them, and this is their only fellowship with the church and members of the church. And there have, over the last several years, I've met people who do not actively participate in the group that will come up and say, I've seen your name, and I appreciate what's going on in the groups. And so I know it reaches a lot further than what we see on our screens. And it means a lot more to people who are just, I guess I shouldn't say it means a lot more, but it means a lot to our friends who don't have a Community of Christ connection other than online and maybe through the Herald. And I wish we could move to a point where people can take ownership for their thoughts and their opinions and their beliefs and not feel threatened and react to other people having a different opinion, belief, or thought than they do. I think that's the biggest burden on my heart when it comes to that is people feeling just because somebody may have a question or they may have a different opinion that they're being attacked. And that's not really the case. And I think people forget that we're talking online. We can't hear the tone. We can't see the expressions. And we're reading into these comments our own interpretation of them. And I think a lot of people see a lot more confrontation than what's really there. And I wish we could move past that more so.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I think, too, that there's also a sense of security behind a screen. Okay. And so maybe people will, you know, intentionally bleed in snark or whatever where it wouldn't ever come in if we are having conversations in real life. I don't post. Exactly. When you're sitting right next to the person that, you know, you're like blasting as a sinner, which I mean, I don't see on the group, but I'm just talking, you know, Facebook or online communication in general. When you're sitting actually, you know, next to that person that you're deeming an other or a sinner or whatever, I don't think that we would all be as quick to, you know, pull out the big guns and start firing. Not saying that there aren't people like that, but I'm very non-confrontational, so. but it does make me think. I don't participate in the group. I read it every day. I don't comment as much. I kind of still feel like a new kid on the block, and so I like hearing what other people have to say. But it does make me stop and think. I mean, I have gotten involved in conversations where I have had preconceived ideas, and then, you know, it's through listening and, you know, reading the words of others that hearts are changed. And I mean, yeah, I won't go into specific details, but there have been some conversations, you know, within the last month or so that I'm like, oh, I have an opinion about that. And then by the time I'm done reading the thread, I think, oh, maybe I wasn't right. I think it's good.
I spend a lot more time editing and then deleting comments I'm going to make than I do actually posting comments. The one thing I do like about doing online compared to face-to-face is I can stop and think. And I
yes.
can read what I'm writing, and I could try to read the tones that are in it. I mean, is somebody going to be able to take what I'm saying and just make it sound like I'm being a jerk? You know what I mean? And or is somebody going to read it and hear trying to be more pastoral? And it's, you know, so I spend a lot of time writing a lot of posts, and most of them are very, very brilliant and very insightful, but I don't post them.
Start posting them.
Well, I try not to dominate our conversation, and I sit there, and as I read some of them, especially the ones we've had over the last couple of weeks on cohabitation and a couple other ones, and I sit there and go, well, do I really have anything to contribute other than just an opinion? And is my opinion really going to move the conversation further then where it's going, you know, what contribution am I really making? Am I contributing more by not participating and just observing, or, you know, so it, for me, it's a lot of weighing and making decisions. I hate when I allow myself to have an emotional knee-jerk reaction and I just jump on there. And there, every now and then you're going to see a post from me where when you click where it says I've edited it, and you're probably going to see a dozen edits because I read the tone and I keep trying to make the tone more diplomatic and compassionate than what I started. I don't know if I'm really successful all the time, but that is the one thing I like about that is I can go back and clarify what I've said, or think through what I've said more than doing it face to face. So that's one thing I really do like about our conversations is I can take the time to think, and I'm not just standing there face to face with someone, they're wondering why it's taking me 20 minutes to respond.
Exactly. I do think I liked the questions that you just said that you sometimes, you know, ask yourself that reflecting on, am I really going to contribute to this conversation, you know, in a positive way, or is my contribution just sitting back and reading and watching? I feel like, yeah, there definitely have been internet regrets in the life of myself and a lot of knee-jerk reactions on certain things. And I think that, yeah, just going back to that security blanket that is the screen, you know, and not realizing that there's actually a person on the other side of the screen. And so to really be careful about tone and snark and assumptions, I think are huge. But yeah, that's interesting. I do think the group is very well managed. And like I said, I feel like it's the best chance that I've had to see Community of Christ live out faithful disagreement. Because there are a lot of flavors in that group. So to me, it's fascinating. And I've been in the group probably a little over a year now. Yeah, and I read it every day. Maybe sometime I'll get brave and start posting more.
Well, what I like about our admin group is I think it's fairly diverse because we have some people with theological views that are probably more conservative, and then some that are way more liberal, but most of us, like in the church, are probably somewhere in the middle. And the same thing, you know, with political views. I mean, there's some that are more leaning to the left than the right, but most of us are probably more really in the middle when it comes to different issues. Another thing with our admin group, our membership is priesthood members, disciples, church employee, or a couple of church employees, a couple of 70s. There's a church historian. Well, John Hammer, well, you all know who John Hammer is. I mean him. And,
yeah.
So we have, right now we have Canadians and United States members on there. I think it would be nice one day if we could spread it out, but most of our membership in the group is Canadian and U.S. I think we have a decent spectrum of admins. I think it'd be nice if we had a little bit more, probably somebody who's a little bit more conservative, and that way it's probably a little bit more balanced in our spectrum. But we work hard. We do a lot of discussion. We really do. We talk about even the perception we have of our own posts. You know, how did that come across? Should I add that? Or how should I even respond? I know some people think we just delete posts and delete members, which is not true. The only time we discuss it, and the only time I can think of that we just delete a post without discussing it is the level of abusiveness was just too much to allow to stay on the screen. But most of the time it's just tone. It's not really what was said, but how it sounds like it's being said. So we discussed that, you know, is this something we want to, you know, do any of us want to go in there and try to redirect the conversation a little bit or make sure a different viewpoint's presented. So we try hard to facilitate the conversation. Once in a while we get, like I said, there's an emotional reaction or we get so involved in the conversation that it's hard not to distance ourselves as an admin from it. You know what I mean? And I think it's good. I think the potential for ministry in it is good. And like I said, there have been people that come up to me and I've been told how much it means to them. So I know it reaches much further than what we think it does. And it reaches a lot more people than who we see participating on the conversations.
Exactly. So since you brought it up, and I guess it's just continuing the conversation, let's talk about online ministry a little bit, just to give everybody a background. When I was presented my call to priesthood, to the office of priest, I had no idea what a priest was, which is kind of embarrassing to admit. But growing up LDS, I just didn't pay attention to it at all. And the crossover isn't perfectly the same. And I was not thinking ordination when I joined Community of Christ. And so I really didn't put much thought or study into it at all. And so when I was presented my call, I thought, I don't know if I can say yes when I don't even know what it is. And, you know, it was explained to me what it was, but I wanted to actually talk to a priest. And our congregation had one, but I knew that Darren had just been ordained just a few months before. And so I shot him a message and I said, I don't know what to do with this. And you calmed me down and talked me through things. And ultimately, I accepted and was ordained. But yeah, that ministry was vital to me. And it's interesting because I know that in smaller ways, or I don't know, maybe not smaller ways, I shouldn't compare them, but I know that in different ways, I've been able to provide ministry for people online as well. So what do you think the value is in that? And I guess in, not in like our generation, but just in this time of online interactions, how do you think that we as a church and we as just humanity need to implement that and integrate that into our lives and use technology for ministry?
Well, I think it's just the way it's going to be. First of all,
yeah.
I mean, it's just one of those things we've got to accept it's there. And it is a great tool when we use it as one. And it's an abusive tool when we use it as one. I think I'm going to try to answer your question, I guess, but I feel like I'm going to do one of my roundabouts.
Well, the question was roundabout, so go for it.
I just think when I was called a priest, I will say something similar to what you said. There were a couple people, and they were all online, who helped mentor me through the night I was called. And the first two people I contacted, or the first three people, was John Nichols and our friend Leon and Art Smith were the first three people I contacted. Pam Robinson was also, and then a couple of old San Diego friends, Mary Andy. So they helped me muddle my way through the calling to trying to come up with an answer. And it took me about a month or just over a month, give or take, which I felt was a long time. And other people told me they've taken a year. So I guess a month was not that long. So there is an important tool with online. Because you can go to people who, for me, I think going to somebody in my congregation to talk about maybe some of the doubts I've had, some of the questions I've had, and some of the things I was struggling with, I don't know how that would have been received. I'm sure it would have been received well as I look back, but it seems safer to go to my friends online and talk to them privately in messages about some of the concerns I've had and getting their feedback and suggestions on how to approach my calling. I think one of the good things about the opportunity for ministry online is we don't know where it's going to come from, and we don't know how we're going to be involved. I think it keeps us on our toes. And every now and then I'll get a message with somebody with a concern or somebody with some sort of struggle, whether it's something in the group or something personal, and I will read it and I feel like, why are you contacting me? And I don't know. I really honestly sit there and don't have any idea what it is that they think I can do for them. But then I realize sometimes when I reach out to people, it's not because I want an answer or I want somebody to do something for me. I just need to get it off my chest. And the ministry is there when we allow it to be there and when we present ourselves in a way that invites an interaction of ministry to happen.
Exactly. Well, I think it's cool that you never know where it's going to come from. I have had a lot of people contact me on and off Facebook, and I never would have expected some of these people to contact me. And a lot of times, I mean, I work a lot with Latter-day Seekers, and a lot of times it's not safe for them to have an interactive conversation in real life. Even if they're down the street from a congregation, it could be detrimental to their family if they went. But yet they want to learn about the church and things. And so they have to do it in a more private way. I guess. And so, yeah, I think it's vital. And I think that, you know, as silly as things like Facebook and even Twitter, like I think, you know, ask Steve Veazey, you know, how many people are just stumbling upon that? And, you know, you never know. Somebody might end up joining the church because they stumble upon a hashtag. You know, it's kind of crazy to think about it, but it's our reality. So yeah, I think that things like the Facebook group and other online ministries are absolutely vital.
And I think that's part of the struggle I have with the group. Well, not with everybody in the group, but there are times which I'm sure you see, and anybody who's listening is probably a member of Dialogue or whatever group they're a part of, this is probably true, is we get so territorial with our beliefs.
Mm.
And so insisting that others view through the same lens we view through. I think we cost ourselves those opportunities for ministry. We end up preaching to the choir that agrees with us. So we get our likes from people who aren't struggling and just want to hear somebody say the same thing we already believe. I won't say that's right or wrong, but I will say when we look beyond just being right and we look beyond just making sure everybody hears our point of view to trying to understand everybody else's point of view are creating an environment where people can express their questions and their doubts and their struggles and not necessarily have an opinion yet. I think we will find a stronger community where we can journey together and grow together instead of setting up all these little stumbling blocks because you don't believe the Book of Mormon the way I believe the Book of Mormon, so you're wrong, and you don't have the same value on stuff that happened in the 1830s to 1840s like I do, so you're wrong, and I'm not saying which values you're placing on that stuff. I'm just saying we get defensive in holding those values that we can't see anybody beyond what we're holding. And I don't know how to express that in a way to help convince more people that you don't have to be defensive about your beliefs. You can take ownership of your beliefs. You can share your beliefs. But you can also allow people to disagree with you and hold different, and they meant to just to be where they're at on their journey. And I don't know why we struggle with that so much.
I don't know why either.
There's a fear of, I guess it's a fear of being alone and it's nobody you relate to. I don't know. I just wish we could get beyond our sense of protecting our views to sharing the table where anybody, make it a potluck, you know, a potluck of views. I don't know. It's just something I struggle with. And I wish I had an idea of how to make it safer for people to feel comfortable in sharing their views without having to force their views on everybody else and for people not to feel like they can't share. I don't know really how we do that other than keep pushing to let people have their view. I don't know.
No, I wish I had a better response than I don't know, but I really don't know. And it's something that I struggle with because I feel like, I mean, at risk of talking about myself, on my journey, I was pretty dogmatic in certain things. And sometimes I think that we just, you know, flip the coin over. I mean, for me, after a faith transition, sometimes it's hard to just flip, you know, to not flip the coin over and be just as dogmatic and try to force somebody down that same exact path that I went. And it might not be what's best for them or, you know, and at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. I mean, does it matter what we think happened in 1830, whatever, you know, it's like you said, it becomes a stumbling block to the mission of Christ. And I guess that's why I appreciate things like the mission initiatives and the enduring principles, because I feel like while they, you know, while Community of Christ upholds history and we study about it objectively and we embrace it and we celebrate it, we really have tried to move away from it not being a stumbling block in either direction, you know? So yeah, that's an interesting conversation. And I don't know what the answer is.
If anybody has an answer, please post.
Yes. Go to the Community of Christ Dialogue page and start a post. Oh man. That's great. So with the online community and dialogue comes a lot of Latter-day Seekers. What is your overall perception or your thoughts on Latter-day Seeker ministry. I know you're active in the Latter-day Seeker group, and you're in Las Vegas, Nevada, which has a very large LDS population. I don't know if you guys have had too many seekers.
I have not, to be honest with you, have seen, nobody has made themselves known to me. So I do know the week before I moved out here, I moved out here October 1st of last year, and I know the weekend before I moved out here, I think Seth came to town, somebody came to town and did a seeker's training, but that was before I was here. So I didn't get to attend that, but I am a little surprised. I have seen more missionaries and more ward buildings in the last 6 months living here than I've seen in my entire life everywhere else. And so I'm a little surprised that we have not seen any seekers in the area or even any questions. I mean, I guess that's good. Maybe in Las Vegas, everybody's happy with their situation and accepts it the way that it is. I don't know. I would like to say if there are any of our LDS friends who are in the Las Vegas area and would like to visit Community of Christ, feel free to send me a message and I will send you the address and make sure I am there or to greet you and welcome you so you're not walking in alone. Yeah. I will send out that invitation. We have talked about in my congregation if seekers wanted to use the building to have meetings and not, and they don't really want to have, join us in worship, which is fine. We would find ways to make sure the building is available for seekers who would like to meet in a safe place that they might not have at home or in an LDS. So that is something any of the listeners who are in the Las Vegas area might be interested in. Feel free to reach out to me and I will be happy to see what I can get worked out.
Yeah.
As far as the online group, I think it appears to be a very good ministry for those searching and struggling and hurting within their LDS experience. I appreciate that people are finding homes within Community of Christ, but I hope the ministry is not being looked at as just to increase numbers and bring people in. I think the ministry is more important than just numbers. Numbers is important, of course, but the ministry of a safe place to share with people who have been through similar experiences, I think, is more important than just new members. So I appreciate that ministry of the Seekers group. I am very grateful to be a part of the group and participate in some of the conversations that have happened, especially when that last announcement a couple months ago that kind of caused the uproar. My brain just went dead and I can't think.
The policy change.
The policy change, thank you.
For the LGBT kids.
That was very, my heart was very burdened for those people who were truly impacted by that and disillusioned by their leadership and finding themselves in a place where they thought was a Christ-like mission ended up not being Christ-like for them at all. That was a very hard time. I appreciate the experience of being a part of that and trying to provide safety.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, you know, that you said that you want to make sure that it's not about the numbers and that true ministry is being done. I think from a Community of Christ perspective, I think that we are doing that well. I don't get the vibe that it's a numbers game, but it just takes a quick flip of the switch for me to start thinking and looking at things how a Mormon would see it. And a lot of times I then feel the need to like make sure that people know, like, we will not be sending people to knock on your doors and we will not, you know, like, you don't have to join. We're not going to throw you in the baptismal font next week. I think maybe sometimes I overcompensate that because I want people to know that they really can be in a place with no obligation, with no strings attached, and that it's authentic. So, but it's kind of, I don't know, it's kind of a balance, especially, I mean, for us here in Utah, when we have people who are at college and in universities where they could be kicked out if they were found that they were interacting with us. And so, yeah, it's kind of, it's a tricky balance, this seeker business, but it's exciting.
Well, I think that's part of the hard thing for Community of Christ members who do not have an LDS background. I don't have an LDS background.
Yeah.
So how the LDS, everything we know tends to be from what you guys tell us and stories we read, but not from firsthand experience. And I think that's where our struggles. We just don't understand. Well, why can't you, you know, raise your hand at conference and discuss this like we do in our conferences? Why can't you write a letter to, you know, the president of your church or your apostle, or, you know, why can't you just talk to them like we do? I know there's a huge cultural difference in how membership and ministerial leadership interact between both organizations. And I think that's where some of our struggling with providing ministry might need some work on, is being more educated on a lot of these cultural differences and how the LDS handle things compared to how we handle.
I've been impressed, though, with the effort. I mean, I've genuinely been touched by, you know, lifelong Community of Christ people that have extended their hand and who are willing to learn the other language that's similar yet different. And yeah, I mean, I know that not everywhere is, I guess, up to speed, so to say, but I think that it's getting there. And I think that that's one reason why it's so important to have online communities. I'm in contact with several people right now that either they don't have a congregation near them, or it's just not safe for them to go. But yeah, I think that this common understanding has been good on both parts. So, okay, well, thanks, Darren. I've really enjoyed this conversation. Is there anything that you would like to say, a closing word to wrap things up a bit?
Well, thank you for having me on. I would just like to again extend the invitation if you're in the Las Vegas area and would like to join us for worship, please contact me, and I will give you information and be there to make sure you don't walk in alone. I'd also like to extend the invitation to join us on the Community of Christ Dialogue Facebook group. You know, feel free to participate as much as you like. Just be aware it is a discussion group, and you will hear opinions and beliefs and ideas that are across the spectrum, and that it's a dialogue group, so it's just getting to know each other better and getting to know ourselves better. That I would just like to make it clear that everybody who wants to participate is invited to participate.
Wonderful. Thank you. And I'll just echo both those invitations, but specifically the one to attend church in Las Vegas. My family was down there a few months ago, and we attended the congregation, and they were so nice and so warm and loving and open, and yeah, you guys are a good bunch down there.
The name of our building is?
Oh, what, the Dolly Parton? Is that what it was? It's two domes, and it's great.
So you can't miss it.
It fits right in with the Vegas vibe. Oh, well, thank you, Darren, and we look forward to seeing you more online. Well,
thank you for the opportunity to share with you.
Okay, bye.
Project Zion is sponsored by the Latter-day Seekers team from Community of Christ. The views expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official views of the Latter-day Seekers team or of Community of Christ.